Dr. Daniel Baxter has treated people with AIDS who have virtually no support system and no community, people who are homeless and often drug addicted, people who are likely to give their address as the bus terminal. His patients have also included prisoners and illegal immigrants. His new memoir, The Least of These, My Brethren, is based on his 3.5 years as a physician at St. Clair's Spelman Center for HIV-related diseases, New York's largest designated AIDS treatment center. Although it's in New York, one visitor described it as resembling a third-world infirmary. I asked Baxter to describe the center.
Well, St. Clair's Hospital is a relatively old hospital established in the early part of this century, and it's located on the west side of Manhattan, actually in Hell's Kitchen, the area where the musical West Side Story was based. And it's really in the middle of a block of tenement buildings, and itself at one time was sort of a hodgepodge or quilt work of tenement buildings that had been joined together into a hospital. And it consists of, when I wrote the book, it consists of 200 beds, of which about 100 to 125 belong to the Spelman service, the AIDS service.
You describe the walls near some of the patients' beds as looking like splatter art, but instead of paint splattered on the floor, on the wall, it was a combination of food and juice and excrement and squished cockroaches.
Yes.
This is really unsanitary stuff. I realize the staff probably wasn't big enough to keep up with the problems, but I mean, how did you think it actually affected the health of the patients?
Probably not seriously, the physical health at least. In terms of the psychological health and, if you will, spiritual health of the patients, it certainly did not help. I refer to room 314 on my unit as the so-called Valley of Sorrows. It was a four-bedded room that really was designed for only two beds. And when you have four beds with all of the other paraphernalia, the suction machines, the bedside commodes, etc., crammed around each bed, there's very little space. And the most incredible thing about that room was that it had no private bathroom. Across the hallway was a small 3-by-4-foot closet that had a small commode and a small sink. And as I said, an Amtrak train has far more spacious bathrooms on each car. And there's no denying the fact that conditions were extremely poor in many cases. But I also try, and I think certainly you realize this, the book is not intended as an expose of these conditions, but rather as a story of how, despite these conditions, the patients there are able to teach us very life-affirming lessons, and the staff there is able to provide wonderful and supportive care.
How much did most of the patients who you treated at the Spelman Center understand how they contracted AIDS?
I would say most of them did. It was the one thing that I indicate about many of my patients was that for them, AIDS was an episodic event. It wasn't the central be-all and end-all that, say, if many of us were to contract HIV, it would not be the central issue of their life. Their lives were far more complicated, and they were facing many daunting problems, such as simply obtaining shelter, getting food stamps, trying to avoid drugs. And for them, AIDS was just one more issue that they had to face. And oftentimes on their list of problems, it was number 3 or 4.
Some of your patients were state prisoners. Did you usually know what the crimes were?
It was general policy at Spelman that the health care givers not know the crimes that the prisoners committed. However, one particular instance that I recall that I found extremely disconcerting was when this one prisoner I was taking care of, who was basically comatose and dying of AIDS, I had discussed his case with his mother, who was a very poor lady in South Carolina, and I was discussing with her on the phone his condition, and she had not seen him for many, many years, and she wanted me to convey to him that she and her church friends down in South Carolina were praying for him, and she said, "Please, doctor, please tell John that I love him." This wasn't the first time a mother over the phone at great distance asked me to convey this message of love, but when I am asked by a mother to do that, I regard that as one of the most important things of the day for me to do. So after talking with John's mother, I saw him on rounds, and although he was comatose, one never knows whether someone in coma can hear or not, and so I leaned over and told him that his mother called and that she wanted him to know that she loved him. And I think that he responded, perhaps he opened his eyes just briefly, and I felt very good about what I had done. But then as I was leaving the room, one of the physician assistants, PAs that also helped me on the ward, blurted out that he had been talking to one of the guards watching John, and the guard had told him that John had committed a terrible, terrible crime 8 years earlier, that he had sodomized a one-year-old girl. And immediately I was frozen with a combination of terror and rage and anger. And at that moment, I both loathed John and I loved him and cared about him, because just a few minutes earlier, I was very desirous of trying to relieve his suffering with the message of love that his mother, whom he had not seen for many years, wanted me to give him. And there's this constant whipsawing back and forth, if you will, of emotions that I experience in trying to deal with someone like this. But ultimately, I realize that if the life of someone like John, who did this terrible crime, but who has his mother that is praying for him, if his life is important and valuable beyond all measure, which it is, then certainly my life, your life, all of our lives are very important.
You know, a lot of the people who you treated at this hospital were homeless. If they recovered from the episode that sent them into the hospital in the first mm-hmm. place, where would you send them? Back to the bus terminal where they lived, or to the subway tunnel where they lived?
No. We at Spelman were blessed with wonderful social workers who really could do miracles, if you will, in terms of getting housing for our homeless people with AIDS. Here in New York, we had fairly good municipal backup services to help in terms of housing. That's been somewhat problematic recently with all of the various cutbacks, both here in the city and also on the state and federal level. But we would be certain that they had either an apartment or, depending upon the level of care they needed, either a nursing home or hospice, and definitely would make every effort to keep them out of the shelters and the bus stations.
My guest is Dr. Daniel Baxter, who's written a memoir about his work on an AIDS ward in Manhattan, and the book is called The Least of These, My Brethren. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Daniel Baxter. His new memoir, The Least of These, My Brethren, is about working with people who were poor, often homeless, often drug addicts, who were in an AIDS ward of a hospital in Manhattan. He worked there for about 3.5 years. The medical staff at this hospital faced a lot of risks. For example, one patient who was a drug addict hid his works in his bedding, and the nurse who was making the bed stuck herself. Mm-hmm. She could have gotten AIDS that way, did she?
No, she did not. The risk of needle stick transmission of HIV is relatively low, about 1/3 of 1%.
And another, were there any of the doctors or healthcare workers at the hospital who actually got AIDS from contact with patients' body fluids or from needle sticks?
Not that I know of. Generally, the exposure to body fluids has an even lower risk of HIV transmission. And that's why it's interesting. Probably at a place like the Spelman Center, the staff is more acutely aware of this risk, and they generally are pretty careful about practicing universal precautions, wearing gloves when they handle any body secretions. And we have the sharps container in each room where the needles that we use on patients are stored safely.
Tuberculosis was a risk, too. You had a number of patients who had TB, and there is a drug-resistant tuberculosis that has been circulating. How do you protect yourselves against that?
Well, if we have a suspicion that someone has TB, or if we know that someone has TB, the patient is put in a respiratory isolation room, and all visitors to the room, including the doctors and nurses, need to wear masks in order to prevent their inhaling the air that has that potentially could have the TB germs in it. But TB is definitely a major risk in caring for folks such as the ones at Spelman. And a couple of the doctors and PAs actually came down with active tuberculosis.
Did they get over it?
Yes, they did. One of them actually had the drug-resistant TB, which requires a more complicated regimen of medications. But that doctor also did get over it, fortunately.
You saw a lot of patients who were dying, and you saw a lot of people coping with death and dealing with death in different ways. Who are some of the patients that really surprised you and how they dealt with their own impending deaths?
Well, there was one patient who was an ex-prisoner who basically had no family. He had a girlfriend that he really did not want us to contact. And he had both PCP, the AIDS pneumonia, and KS, Kaposi's sarcoma, in his lungs. And he briefly responded to therapy. But whenever I would go in and see him and try to provide him emotional support, he would turn the tables on me and end up providing me emotional support. And he would say, you know, doc, it's all right. It's okay. It's all right that I'm sick and that I'm dying. And this particular patient had an inner serenity and calmness. He wanted to live. He was willing to undergo chemotherapy treatment for his KS. He was willing to undergo diagnostic treatment. So he wasn't, in a way, throwing in the towel. But on the other hand, he had an acceptance of death. And I remember as he was getting sicker and sicker, and I would go in more to see him more to marvel at the acceptance and tranquility that he had. I remember one of his last words were, it's okay, doc. It's okay. You shouldn't fear death. And it was amazing because this was someone that ostensibly, you know, did not know the great philosophers, but he had a more centered life than many people have after years and years of psychotherapy, et cetera.
There, the greatest hope for a lot of people with AIDS now is the new combination drug therapy. Mm-hmm. It's more effective. It's decreasing the viral load in a lot of patients. But there is a debate over whether, quote, unreliable patients should get it, meaning patients who are homeless or schizophrenic or who are drug addicts and who are unlikely to adhere to the very rigid schedule that these drugs demand. You recently had an op-ed piece in the New York Times in which you said that you thought that treatment should not be withheld from, quote, unreliable patients. Why not?
Well, because I think that, first of all, I think that many of the so-called unreliable patients, at least in my experience, have turned out to be quite reliable. These folks are very smart, they're very street smart, and they know that these new drugs, in many cases, do work. And they have clamored for them, and in my experience, I've been very amazed at how they're willing to take a fairly complicated medication regimen because somehow intuitively they know that this is going to work and that it will work. They see their friends that are on these medications flourishing, and this is another incentive for them to be compliant with their medications. But there's a larger issue very quickly, namely that if word gets out on the streets that doctors are picking and choosing who they treat, these people are going to get the medications on the streets in the black market one way or the other.
Have you used the combination therapy with any of your patients?
Oh, absolutely. At Casa Promesa, the AIDS facility in the South Bronx I work at, I would say 40 to 50% of our patients are on combination therapy. We have seen, and although this is anecdotal, nonetheless, it's really quite impressive. We have seen many people almost literally take up their bed and walk, if you will, as a result of these combination therapies.
Now, how do people who aren't used to following a regimen, watching the clock all the time, deal mm-hmm. with the really tight schedule that you have to follow to take the drugs?
Well, they write down, maybe they'll put it on the refrigerator, the exact time that they need to take medications. They'll set their alarm clock. We will have visiting nurses that will come in to help them in terms of giving them pill containers, little pill boxes with the time. It is difficult. But I think that we sometimes can focus in too much on these so-called unreliable patients and realize that many people, including doctors, can't even take one pill four times a day regularly. And perhaps we're holding them to these, our patients, to a little higher standard.
What about patients who are homeless, who don't have alarm clocks, who don't have a home where a nurse can come visit them?
Mm-hmm. That is a far, far more difficult problem. And I think that rather than address the issue primarily of their HIV care, the first issue should be their homelessness. Many times, with a lot of the folks that I take care of, trying to treat AIDS first is, if you'll pardon the cliche, putting the cart before the horse. And that's why we've had so much problem and difficulty in treating HIV disease in the marginalized population in this country, because we throw at them these so-called wonder drugs, and because they can't take them exactly right and perfectly, we say, well, you know, you can't have them. The first and foremost issue should be addressing the far graver and more serious socioeconomic and psychological problems that these people have.
A lot of the patients, obviously, who you saw when you worked at this AIDS hospital died. Mm-hmm. Was there a way of memorializing them within the hospital to mark their passing?
Yes. Every 3 months, the pastoral care department at Spelman would have a memorial service in the small chapel at St. Clair's. And this memorial service where for about 30 minutes, all of the staff of Spelman, some of the patients' families, although many of them were not able to make it there, would assemble in the small jewel-like chapel of St. Clair's Hospital. And there would be what they call the reading of names, where there would be a list of people that had died on the Spelman service the previous 3 months. Usually there would be anywhere from 15 to 25 names called forth from the altar every 3 months.
You stayed at St. Clair's, this Manhattan-based hospital with the AIDS ward. You stayed there for about 3.5 years.
Yes.
And now you're working in the South Bronx at an AIDS hospice.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you leave St. Clair's?
Several reasons. I always like challenge. I like something that is going to, in a way, make my life a little more difficult and challenging. And after 3.5 years, I felt that I had a fairly good grasp on inpatient AIDS care. Outpatient AIDS care, which is what I do now in the South Bronx, has its own set of problems and challenges. Many of the people that I take care of now, although they're the same as the patients at St. Clair's, are actually a little healthier, and so they're a little more difficult, if you will, in terms of addressing their HIV-related problems. So I wanted a challenge. I wanted a change. Also, I frankly needed some distance in order to write the book. So those were the two main reasons. I still keep in touch very closely with the folks at St. Clair's, especially Sister Pascal Conforti, the director of pastoral care there.
Dr. Baxter, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Daniel Baxter is the author of the memoir, The Least of These, My Brethren.